Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Make or Break European Summit now underway in Brussels and speak with Charles Kupchan, who was Director for European Affairs on the National Security Council in the Clinton administration. With the German Chancellor saying the Euro has lost credibility and the French leader warning there is no turning back, we'll try to find out if their apocalyptic words will be met with credible deeds and a global economic crisis will be avoided in the next 24 hours as the deadline to come up with a plan to shore up the Euro looms. Then we will look into the apparent loss of a top-secret US spy drone over Iran that appears to have been captured largely intact by the Iranians, who claim their army's electronic warfare unit hacked into the stealth RQ-170 Sentinel's controls and landed it 140 miles inside their territory. An expert on defense, space, and intelligence policy, John Pike, the director of globalsecurity.org, joins us to try to assess the damage to the CIA from this incident that appears to be both a diplomatic embarrassment and an intelligence setback for the United States. Then finally, we'll address the Senate's rejection of Richard Cordray, who the White House nominated as the first head of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Bartlett Naylor, the financial policy advocate at Public Citizen, joins us to discuss the Republicans' apparent allegiance to Wall Street over Main Street and their efforts to kill a new agency created to combat unfair, deceptive, and abusive lending practices that brought about the 2008 financial crisis that continues to depress the real economy today, while bailed-out, bonus-bloated banking gamblers in the Wall Street casino laugh all the way to the bank. Joining us now is Charles Kupchan, who was Director of European Affairs on the National Security Council during the Clinton administration. He's now a Professor of International Affairs in Georgetown University School of Foreign Service and is a Senior Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Welcome to Background Briefing, Charles Kupchan.
Happy to join you.
And clearly we have a fairly dire situation in Europe, at least recently. The new Italian Prime Minister said that if an agreement is not made by Friday, December 9th, the markets will effectively crash the euro. Do you feel that at this point where you've got Chancellor Merkel arriving in Brussels for the European summit saying that the credibility of the euro must be restored, and then prior to that you had Sarkozy speaking in very apocalyptic terms about the great crisis facing Europe, do you think that these leaders are going to finally deal with this problem that's taken 18 months, and the longer they dither, the more expensive the bailout becomes?
Well, it is way past due that you've got the key players getting together and talking about the kinds of institutional and financial changes that are necessary to save the euro. And even more importantly, it's way past due that you finally got Merkel in particular, but also Sarkozy and others, the new technical prime minister of Italy, Mr. Monti, talking in very serious terms, because up till now they have been following the public. They have been lagging behind public opinion that is growing weary, that is skeptical of more European integration. And finally they're saying, listen, this is a make or break moment. This is not just the euro that's on the line. It could be the European project that's on the line. And so finally I think you're seeing the kind of leadership that's necessary. And part of the reason you're getting these rather apocalyptic statements is to try to shock publics and their counterparts into action. I don't think that the lights will go out if we don't have an agreement by December 9, but certainly the markets will punish the economies of the Eurozone more if there isn't a resolution.
So would this apocalyptic talk, with Sarkozy saying recently in Marseille that never has the risk of the disintegration of Europe been greater, the idea that they're preparing their publics, it seems that one of the criticisms of Angela Merkel and her inability, apparently since they're the biggest player in the Eurozone, to come to grips with this crisis has been her own domestic considerations, where the German people simply aren't prepared to accept the idea that a huge bailout is necessary, and they've tended to blame a lot of it on the lazy Greeks and Italians and not the German banks who have obviously made bad loans.
That's exactly right. And Merkel, for whatever reason, made a calculation a couple of years ago that she was going to play it safe and that she was going to mind the coalition that she's in, that she was going to close the nuclear reactors after the Fukushima accident, that she was going to vote no to the Libya intervention in the UN Security Council, all for the sake of kind of catering to, or I would go so far as to say pandering to, certain sentiments within the domestic electorate. And I think what's happened now is she's woken up to the fact that the euro might disappear and that the European project is on the line. And finally, she has realized that it's time to step up to the plate and to turn the gas on high. And the big question is it too little too late, or can she reverse this tide of public opinion that is getting more nationalistic, less pro-European, and get publics to back a move toward what is unquestionably a tighter union, a not a federation in the American sense, but institutions that would give Europe the kind of fiscal responsibility that Brussels should have had when the euro was introduced over 10 years ago.
Again, I'm speaking with Charles Kupchan, who was Director of European Affairs on the National Security Council during the Clinton administration. And I take it that if you were in the current Obama White House, there'd be a lot of nail-chewing going on. The president recently hosted a European summit where he clearly pressed the Europeans to deal with this situation. And it would seem in a paradoxical sense that Obama's re-election fate in 2012 could well be in the hands of Angela Merkel if they don't get it together, and if Greece leaves the euro in an untidy way and the markets beat the euro to death, then you'll have a global recession, and that will extend here to the United States. So what do you think the president has been saying to the European leaders?
Well, I think there's been a lot of communication behind the scenes because Obama and company have not wanted to appear to be lecturing the Europeans. That could do more harm than good. But behind closed doors and on the phone, I think Obama and Tim Geithner, the Treasury Secretary, and others have been saying, you know, please do what is necessary at the scale that is necessary to calm the markets and to prevent a contagion going from Greece to Italy, to Spain, and then across the Atlantic. And that contagion is a real possibility. I mean, but we Americans have a lot of money invested in European banks. If those banks go wobbly, then our banks go wobbly. And then there's the other issue that, Ian, even under the best of circumstances, we're looking at low rates of growth on the other side of the Atlantic. And that's because what's being discussed now between the key leaders involves a lot of austerity and fiscal constraint, going down to rather low levels of debt. And that means that you're not going to get the growth in Europe that the United States would like to see to help stimulate growth across the global economy. And so I think Obama, to some extent, sees the writing on the wall, and that is that he's going to be heading into re-election at a time when the Western economies as a whole are sluggish. And I think that's why just this week he has begun to take a rather populist tone and try to appeal to the vast swath of America's middle class that has seen its houses foreclosed upon and its wages decline in real terms over the last decade.
So, Charles Kupchan, when the Secretary of Treasury, as he did recently, said that the Europeans have to step up, he also talked about, and he has talked about this for some time, the need for a firewall, a kind of financial firewall to stop the markets from pounding the euro. And obviously, you know, some of the debt's becoming unsustainable now in Italy. And for all intents and purposes, Greece has already dropped off the cliff. Mm-hmm. One statistic that I find that really puts it in perspective, and in fact in an alarming way, is that a couple of economists who are following this European crisis have said that in 2008, and obviously the concern here is that there'll be another Lehman Brothers event in Europe. So if you go back to the 2008, the Lehman Brothers event, the Fed, which the Europeans don't have, put up something like $29 trillion to stabilize the markets back and to stop that crisis from creating a global depression. Conversely, the Europeans so far, the ECB, has only put up €500 billion. So it just seems to me that they're not even anywhere near facing the reality of what this challenge is.
Well, you've sort of got a double whammy. One aspect of it is what you're talking about, and that's the economies of scale and the fact that the Europeans haven't had the willingness to put on the line the kinds of guarantees and loans that are necessary to calm the markets. And that's why the markets keep coming after them. And that's why the bill for acting keeps going up. The longer you wait, the more expensive the tab. And then the other problem is that, you know, as you put it, they don't have a Fed. They don't have a set of institutions in Europe that can moderate this crisis. They do have the European Central Bank, but that doesn't have the kind of authority that we have in the United States vested in the Federal Reserve or the Treasury. But then you have each of the separate national institutions. And a lot of people worried when the euro was introduced, started circulating in 2002, that this is dangerous, that you're heading in to a single currency without the appropriate kinds of institutional oversight, and the Europeans knew it. But the politics weren't there, so they went ahead anyway and prayed that it would work, and the prayers didn't come to fruition, and now they're paying the bill. And that's exactly what Merkel and Sarkozy are discussing now. That is, can we, in hindsight, put the institutions in place to make the euro function successfully? And right now, the jury is still out.
And Charles Kupchan, Angela Merkel has made it clear that she wants the treaty to be changed, and others have suggested that won't be that easy. We subject, as the Swedish Prime Minister said, changing the treaty would take time and trigger the need for a referendum. Here we're talking about if they don't come to deal with this by tomorrow, there's likely to be even a crash of the euro and a global economic crisis. So how do you bring about these changes that this Franco-German plan apparently is based upon a number of provisions, which are to impose penalties for nations that run excessive budget deficits? All 17 Eurozone nations should amend their national legislation to require a balanced budget. The Eurozone countries will have a common corporation and financial transaction taxes, and any future bailouts would not require private investors to absorb part of the cost, as happened with Greece. That's just some of what is on the table. How do you get those kind of an agreements done so quickly when you've got, 27 EU nations here, all of whom will have to sign off on this?
Well, you know, you've got the short term and the long term. In the shorter term, you want to try to increase the capitalization of their stability fund. You want to try to give a sense to investors that banks in Europe are safe. And some of that has already happened, but more needs to be done. And then there's the longer term, and that is the changes to the treaty and the changes to the institutions of Europe to provide the kind of oversight to make sure that this won't happen again. And that's not easy, because depending upon the nature of the changes, you might have to go to public referenda. And public referenda are very complicated. You may recall that in 2005, there was a constitutional treaty. There was an effort by the European Union to sort of do what we did in 1789, to have a sort of constitutional ratification. Well, guess what? It didn't fly, because it was rejected in popular referenda in France and in the Netherlands, and then they sort of scuttled the whole thing, and they don't want to go down that road. So I think what they're going to be looking for is some kind of package deal whereby you don't necessarily in each country have to go to the publics. And the other change that is afoot now is that it may not well be the 27 euro EU members. It may be the 17 euro members. There's a subgroup within the European Union that uses the euro and the rest don't. And I think a country like Britain is not ready to move down this road. So what you may end up with is what's called a multi-speed Europe, an inner core based upon France and Germany that moves more quickly to deeper integration, and Britain and other countries on the periphery hanging back.
Again, I'm speaking with Charles Kupchan, who was Director for European Affairs on the National Security Council during the Clinton administration. He's now a Professor of International Affairs at Georgetown's University School of Foreign Service and is a Senior Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Well, just in that context, Charles Kupchan, the EU's most recent treaty, which was adopted in Lisbon in 2007, that took 8 years to negotiate. You mentioned the British. The New York Times is carrying a front page story on Thursday suggesting that the British are, are sort of, you know, spectators, helpless spectators on the side. How would you characterize Cameron's role in this?
Well, Cameron, I think, is in an awkward position. He is the head of a party, at least one major section of which is openly Europhobic. And if it were up to them, they would get out of the EU tonight. In fact, not many weeks ago, there was a move among the Tory backbenchers to put forward a referendum to the British public for Britain's future participation in the EU, and that was blocked. But public opinion polls showed at the time that if, in fact, there were a referenda, that a majority of the people who vote would call for withdrawal. And so what that does is it puts Cameron in an awkward position because he cannot be part of Europe's core because he'll alienate his party. But he also doesn't want to completely back away from the EU because it leaves Britain isolated. It leaves Britain marginalized. And I do think that the British face a tough choice looking forward, and that is if Europe does emerge from this crisis stronger, if there are new levels of integration, either Britain gets on the wagon and becomes a leading member of Europe, or it drifts off into Never Never Land, because the idea that it can somehow either be the bridge to the United States or go off on its own is increasingly infeasible in a globalized world. And so I think the British have tough choices ahead when it comes to their relationship to Europe.
Well, the British have also adopted austerity measures that have clearly slowed their economy and ground it to a halt. And, of course, that is also what's happened in Greece. And a lot of what's happening here, I think, is very paradoxical in as much as the only thing that's in the real economic world that allows you to pay off your debts is revenues, and revenues come from economic growth, and austerity stifles growth. So that's a formula that's failed in Greece and failed in England, yet it's still being talked about in the context of what needs to be done here in Europe.
Well, I think that they on both sides of the Atlantic, we are stuck in a situation where we don't have a consensus on how much to cut and how much to stimulate. And as a consequence, we're getting stuck in the middle on both sides of the Atlantic. And I also think a bigger problem that is affecting Europe, and it's affecting us in some ways even more profoundly, is that the stagnation of America's middle class, the impact of globalization on inequality, the degree to which Americans feel that their kids' lives will be of lower quality than their lives, that is making our political institutions, that is making Western democracies weak, ineffective. It's sapping their strength. And I think that one of the reasons that Europe has found it so difficult to deal with this crisis is that it has sluggish, angry, and discontented electorates, which is exactly what we've got here in the United States. So in some ways, this is a problem. This is the problem of deindustrialization and the hollowing out of the middle class is something that is being shared right across the liberal democracies.
Well, in Spain, you've got virtually half of the young Spaniards unemployed.
I mean, 20%+ of Spaniards as a whole are unemployed. And you're right. When you look at the youth, it's somewhere approaching 50%.
So there was some suggestions in order to explain the kind of what's been the Europeans have been accused of, a kind of fecklessness in the face of this 18-month-long crisis, starting with Greece and And as you pointed out, and many others have, the longer you delay the solution, the more expensive the costs become. So it does seem puzzling as to why it has taken so long to reach this point now where both the key players, Merkel and Sarkozy, Germany and France, are talking the kind of language of this is a make or break moment, as Sarkozy said. One explanation that was offered to me by an economist was that there are elements within the highest council of these debates that perhaps explains this, that feel that something has to be done to break the social contracts, to make the Europeans more competitive in this new global economy that you referred to. And that gets to the heart of a real question, doesn't it, about whether you can maintain a standard of living of an American middle class at the same time compete with the Chinese peasants, et cetera.
Yeah, and I do think that we're dealing with a structural problem here, and that our societies and our politics were predicated upon a certain economic model. That economic model has been shattered by globalization and the entry of billions of low-wage workers into the marketplace. And I think that's the main reason that our middle classes and Europe's middle classes and Japan's middle classes are struggling. And that has led to a crisis of governability. It has led to a loss of legitimacy of our domestic institutions. And here in the United States, public opinion of Congress is at historic lows. And that, I think, is the core of the explanation for why Europeans have reacted so slowly. Because this crisis hit at the same time that elites were feeling their electorates run away from them, and at the same time that Europe was being renationalized by the discontent of voters, by a double dislocation, not just European integration, but integration into global markets. And so voters were sort of pulling away. They were saying, what's happening here? I'm losing control over my destiny. And up till now, Merkel and Sarkozy and others were pushed along by the populism, by the renationalization of political life. And I think that's why they didn't act. And now they're staring reality in the face, and they're realizing that they have to reverse course and provide bold leadership. Otherwise, it may soon be game over.
Well, just in closing, Charles Kupchan, it does seem, though, that in many ways, Germany has been the fair-weather friend here. Because at the end of the day, although so much, there's been this north-south divide, this economic problem has to some extent been racialized. I mentioned earlier the notion of the lazy Greeks and Italians who don't pay their taxes. But in reality, it's the German and French banks who were profligate in these loans, particularly the enormous amount of the big housing bubble in Spain, et cetera, largely for Germans' holiday homes were built. But the long and the short of it is, I think it's pretty clear that the Germans, as the center of the euro, have really benefited from it from the beginning, particularly with their export-driven economy. And now it seems that they don't want to pay the piper.
Well, you know, I wouldn't be too hard on the Germans in the sense that they have tightened their belts. They have gone through some of the structural reforms that other European countries need to. And they have been remarkably successful at a brand of high-quality manufacturing that has enabled them to remain competitive despite the entry of Chinese and Malaysian and Indonesian workers into the marketplace. So they've done a good job. They've done an impressive job. But you're also right to point out, number one, that a lot of their income has come from exports to the laggards, the so-called laggards in Europe's periphery, like Greece. So they've benefited from the asymmetries in the Eurozone. And secondly, a lot of the debts that have accumulated in Greece, in Ireland, in Portugal, and other places are held by European banks. There was a credit bubble, an overheating, not unlike there was here in the United States, particularly on real estate, but also on other investments. But I think that it, whether or not you see Germany as having benefited from the game or having contributed to the crisis, they're the most important player. They're the biggest economy. They have the most political influence, and that's why it's so important that Merkel finally seems to have awoken from a deep slumber looked out her window, saw Europe sinking, and said, Jesus, I better get in the game.
Well, Charles Kupchan, I thank you so much for joining us.
It's been my pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Charles Kupchan, who was Director of European Affairs on the National Security Council during the Clinton administration. He's now a professor of international affairs in Georgetown University School of Foreign Service and is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the apparent capture by the Iranians of the very high-tech latest spy platform that the United States has.
Money makes a world go around. These words it makes a world go around. The clinking, clanking sound can make the world go round. Money, 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 money.